Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President of Mexico's cancellation of a scheduled visit to Washington to meet with his friend Donald Trump, who effectively gave him no choice after humiliating Peña Nieto by insisting that Mexico will pay for Trump's wall with a 20% tax on imports from Mexico. We will go to Mexico City and speak with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, an author and a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, and discuss his article at The Atlantic, How Mexico's President Laid the Foundation for a Wall, and look into Peña Nieto's fealty towards Donald Trump, whose presidential campaign was helped immensely by Mexico's president, who staged a photo op for Trump back in August to make him look presidential and shore up his foreign policy credentials in an apparently vain hope that Trump would reciprocate. We will also examine the consequences of tearing up NAFTA, which has been a disaster for Mexicans, while benefiting U.S. farmers and corporate America. Then we'll assess the damage to U.S. foreign policy from the hollowing out of the State Department with abrupt departures of many of its top officials. Wayne White, who served as the Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, joins us to discuss Trump's appointment of two callow political neophytes from a right-wing website and a Koch brothers front group who are now running the Voice of America, which will soon lose its global credibility and become a Fox News-like propaganda arm of the new administration. Then finally, we will look into today's turning of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists' doomsday clock closer to midnight in a symbolic recognition of a drift towards Armageddon that we have not seen since 1953 when the Soviet Union exploded its first hydrogen bomb. Lawrence Krauss, the director of the Origins Project and foundation professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Physics Department at Arizona State University, joins us to discuss growing concerns that Donald Trump's reckless talk about nuclear weapons and denial of scientific facts is moving us closer to midnight, midnight being the apocalypse. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who is an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México and vice president of the International Association of Administrative Law. He has contributed to many publications in the U.S., Mexico, and the U.K. on the topics of corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. And he has an article at The Atlantic, How Mexico's President Laid the Foundation for a Wall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mill Ackerman.
Great to talk to you as always, Ian.
So, John, the president of Mexico, I think, was forced into having to cancel this visit. It seemed like Trump had effectively humiliated him in advance. And if he had any self-respect, and I'm sure there was a lot of pressure at home for him to stand up for his own country, which was clearly being insulted by the new president of the United States, who is insisting on building this wall and still insisting that somehow or other Mexico is going to pay for it.
Yes, well, Peña Nieto was indeed cornered into this decision. He didn't want to take it. He waited as long as possible to cancel and sort of canceled it too late because really, effectively, Trump had canceled it previously. This Thursday in the morning, Trump put a tweet out saying, you know, what's the point of a meeting if Mexico is going to continue to be so stubborn about them not paying the wall for the wall? And then finally, Peña Nieto said, well, okay, well, then I won't go. But really, it was Trump who shut the door. And Peña Nieto has really kind of been playing the part of a lapdog. He's been sort of begging Trump to take him into account. Peña Nieto directly, and this is what I write about in The Atlantic, participated in the Trump campaign. You know, people talk about Putin in Russia with his, you know, covert operation through internet, and you know that's got to be, you know, proved and investigated. But the Mexican intervention was absolutely public and overt. The Mexican president, Peña Nieto, organized a campaign event in Los Pinos, the presidential palace, on August 31st, and it actually had an impact. If you look at the polls, as of September 1st, Trump starts to catch up to Hillary Clinton, because it was really important for Trump to, you know, present himself up as a statesman, as someone who could be taken seriously by foreign leaders. and also as a friend, quote unquote, of Mexicans, simultaneously with his attack on Mexicans. So I mean, it really sort of rounded out the media spectacle for Trump. And Peña Nieto was a willing collaborator, and he appointed his new foreign minister, Videgaray, was the man who brought Trump in at that visit. He had no foreign diplomacy experience, but he's now Peña Nieto's foreign minister. That sort of, you know, an offering also to Trump. And the day before Trump was about to come in, you know, sent over the Chapo Guzman. That was also very suspicious. That looked very much like Peña Nieto also trying to sort of get in with Trump, showing him that he's going to be subservient. But that's not enough for Trump. You know, Trump needs to insult and humiliate. And finally, Peña Nieto has been pushed to make this decision. But I'm not too confident that, you know, Peña Nieto has actually changed his opinion or come around and now decided to, you know, defend Mexico. I wouldn't go that far.
So what is the basis of the extent to which Peña Nieto really did help Trump out? And that was that definitely did make a difference. He was widely understood, have no foreign policy experience, and yet he made this quick trip down to Mexico and looked presidential, and it was all laid on for him. And clearly, you know, they sent a helicopter to pick him up, the president's own helicopter. They had a joint press conference adorned with American and Mexican flags in the big stateroom where foreign dignitaries meet. And Peña Nieto praised Trump, even though they had their ritual disagreement over the wall that was pushed to the side. And Trump proclaimed Peña Nieto as his friend. So it was a major love fest photo op. So why did Peña Nieto do it? What did Peña Nieto see that most of us didn't, which was we all expected Hillary Clinton to win, and that's pretty much across the board?
Trump and Peña Nieto are really kind of kindred spirits. There's this false impression, at least in the United States, that somehow Trump's Latin American equivalent would be Hugo Chavez or Evo Morales, so-called populists. This is just wrong. You know, Evo Morales, Hugo Chavez, we could talk about them for hours, but, you know, they're in the end, ideologically and principally trying to, you know, help the poor, beef up the state support for social welfare. While Trump is, you know, totally neoliberal. He's a corporate cat, and that's what Peña Nieto is too. That's why they get along so well. That's why the wall doesn't bother either of them very much. You know, in this press conference in August, Peña Nieto explicitly said that, you know, that he agreed with Trump on the basic issues of, you know, border control. Peña Nieto has been building his own wall of sorts in southern Mexico to stop Central American migrants. So those are the really, you know, the similar guys, Peña Nieto and Trump, not Chavez or Evo. And a wall is a perfect thing with for someone with a neoliberal perspective, because, you know, neoliberalism is all about, you know, free flow of, you know, capital, but without the corresponding flow of labor, because that makes things a lot more complicated, because you have to actually start paying people more and working towards social justice.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who's an author as well as a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México and vice president of the International Association of Administrative Law. He has contributed to many publications in the U.S., Mexico, and the U.K. on the topics of corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. And he has an article at The Atlantic, How Mexico's President Laid the Foundations for a Wall. And he joins us from Mexico City. So what's the sense, though, in Mexico of national pride? This wall, it strikes me as an inherent insult. It has all kinds of ecological catastrophes associated with it. It's impractical. It's insulting because it doesn't have any real function. He plans to build extremely high, like the wall between the Israelis and the Palestinians, as though, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And yet, of course, he can't do anything about the Rio Grande because of a treaty from 1970. At least I don't think he can. But most analysts say, you know, and of course now they're trying to finesse the cost between 10 and 12 billion. Paul Ryan says that's complete nonsense. It would be at least 20 billion. But maybe, you know, they'll sell it like they sold the Keystone XL pipeline, that it's a job creator. But the general consensus is that it's not ever going to happen. What's the feeling in Mexico?
Yes, it is highly symbolic. You know, imagine Russia or Iran forcing the United States to pay for their missile defense system. You know, I mean, that's the equivalent. This is why should one country pay for the other country to defend themselves from themselves, right? It's just absolutely absurd. It's highly symbolic, and it's this sort of, you know, this macho attitude by Trump trying to force Mexico to do so. The other thing is that it's just basically impossible to actually force Mexico to pay for this wall. I mean, politically, it's absolutely unfeasible. They're not going to, no matter how much they try to confiscate remittances or, you know, declare a commercial trade war against Mexico, they're not going to ever convince even Peña Nieto, who would love to pay for the wall, I think, but even he couldn't do it given the public opinion in Mexico. I mean, you know, people are very upset about this and would not accept this from happening. And so in the end, it's going to be the United States who's going to pay for it, whether it be through tariffs or taxes or whatever you want to call it. It's going to be U.S. consumers in the end and taxpayers who pay for this ridiculous wall. Now, there already is a barrier. You know this. You know, Clinton has covered from his time a third of the border with fencing and this kind of stuff. And like you said, there's the river, and there are difficulties with building barriers on that river for environmental and also treaty reasons. But Trump doesn't care about that. He just wants to put that symbol out there as his great achievement, because that was his big promise. I don't know. It seems like it's going to be difficult to get out of this situation because Mexico is not going to fold, even with Peña Nieto, and the United States and Trump is taking this so personal. So it seems to me that what we really need is a bi-national Mexican-American alliance more from the grassroots. That seems to me the only possible way of actually putting pressure. You know, there was a woman's march last week. Let's do a migrant and Mexican march next week. It seems to me we got to go back to the basics.
Well, but his other line of attack, of course, is to undo NAFTA. And while not defending NAFTA, it has been in play for some time. And what could he do in terms of raising tariffs, for example, on all the automobiles that are built in Mexico that are then exported to the United States? Is there an expectation that he's going to do something along those lines?
Yeah, there's pretty clear signals that he's going to, just as he already has with the TPP, he's going to withdraw from NAFTA and sign the specific binational treaties with Canada and the United States, but in Canada and Mexico, as well as other countries on the Pacific Rim. That means danger for Mexico. I'm not a supporter of NAFTA, never was. Mexico should never have gone this route. This was the fantasy of entering into the first world through forgetting about Latin America and integrating itself to North America. This is the Carlos Salinas dream from 20-some years ago. It's failed. The purchasing capacity of the salaries in Mexico has gone down. Growth has basically stagnated about 2% a year. The minimum wage in Mexico is now 44 cents an hour. NAFTA has not actually lifted up Mexico toward the first world, but it has disarticulated, destroyed the countryside, disarticulated in general, fragmented the national economy, and made us in Mexico incredibly dependent on the United States. So if it were sort of repealed just from one day to the next, this could lead to serious economic crisis. We're already in the middle of an economic crisis. We've had massive devaluation. 50% has been lost in the pace of the last 4 or 5 years, ever since Peña Nieto came in. But with a unilateral one day to the next withdrawal from NAFTA would create real waves in the Mexican economy. But the silver lining is that this would give an opportunity for Mexico to go back to more national based development, making alliances with Latin America, with Asia, with the world, trying to become more self-sufficient in terms of food, for instance. Mexico is a big country. It's the 15th country in the world, largest economy in the world, a $1 trillion economy. It's not like we're just going to be abandoned like a small island in the wind. We've got a lot to build on.
Right, but it's not well understood here in the United States. Donald Trump ran on the idea that NAFTA has hurt the American worker, with no understanding, it seems, on this side of the border of how much it's hurt the Mexicans, particularly the ejidos, the farmers, the people that were scrapping out a living on these marginal pieces of land because all the good land is owned by the big landowners, the caciques. And basically, they've had to import food. It's been a catastrophe for Mexico's self-sufficiency in terms of food. Well,
exactly, or migrate to the United States. And why was there this incredible wave of migration to the United States between, 98 and 2010? Almost 500,000 Mexicans each year were crossing the border. I mean, that's what is upsetting so much to Trump so upset and his followers so upset of all this, influx of Mexicans to the United States. Why does that happen? Precisely because their welfare has been destroyed, cut out from under them by NAFTA. If Mexico, along with support from the United States and other countries, had gone a different route, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation. And to now go the other way, immediately to sort of revoke NAFTA and punish Mexico for supposedly, abusing of its free trade status, is just, creating the problem even worse. It will probably lead to another increase of wave of migration, which will create exactly the opposite of what Trump is saying he's trying to achieve, which is, isolating the United States and stopping the Mexicans. It might lead to an increase in Mexican migration.
So given that it hurt the peasants and forced this massive migration off the land for the peasantry, for the want of a better description, to come here, and of course the old joke was Vicente Fox promised 10 million jobs. The only problem was they all ended up in America. So we know that's happened. But on the other hand, it's made the ruling families even more richer. And you've got one of the richest men in the world is a Mexican, Carlos Slim. And that all happens in the post-NAFTA environment. So presumably there are people in corporate America who like NAFTA. And presume yes. So are they going to push back against Trump?
Well, that's just a larger question. It doesn't have to do only with NAFTA. To what extent the corporate Hillaryites are just going to jump on board with Trump, and to what extent are they actually going to create a different kind of vision? I mean, the defeat of Hillary Clinton is the defeat of a specific vision of neoliberal capitalist democracy, which I think is going to be hard to recuperate. History is back. We've got the right and the left. I don't know. Bernie Sanders was for renegotiating NAFTA as well, getting out of the TPP. I think it's going to be hard to go back to that old world, which was not exactly ideal anyway. So we're in a process of birth pangs, which is going to depend on each one of us, putting our two cents in to help history move forward and not backwards, because we're in a very unstable moment.
Well, the other aspect, of course, of this very star-crossed relationship between these two countries, with a sharing an almost 2,000-mile-long border, Mexico and the United States, in effect a first world and a third world country intersecting, that in itself is pretty unusual. And yet we talked about the humiliation of Peña Nieto by his friend Donald Trump, and now the tearing up of NAFTA. But the other aspect, of course, is what happens to so many of the so-called dreamers, the young children of immigrants who came here, had children. Children grew up here, and because they're not documented, their lives are in jeopardy in terms of being forced to return to countries that they don't even know. And, of course, it's even worse for those from Central America, particularly from lawless countries like El Salvador, which is effectively run by street gangs and criminal gangs. And that's been one of the reasons why these kids fled, or their parents put them on this hazardous journey. Because my understanding is that for immigrants to escape from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to go through Mexico is a very, very cruel rite of passage, is it not?
Yes, of course. On that last point, Peña Nieto has been terrible with migrants. He's been, this is a responsibility of Obama, not Trump. Obama, the great deporter, not only deported from the United States, but also forced or pressured the Mexican government to enforce basically U.S. immigration policy on the Mexican southern border with Guatemala. And that's a real disgrace. And about the Dreamers, yes, this is also a terrible fear that Trump is putting into these young kids, students in the United States. It's a real disgrace, that situation. I think we should look at the other side too, in terms of the fact that Mexico is not such a bad place. I would encourage the Mexican nationals who are in this situation. Of course, we need to defend them and support them, but also let's create our own little utopia on Earth here in Mexico. Let's kick Peña Nieto out and build on all the wonderful resources, history, even laws and culture, of course, that we have in Mexico to construct a different vision of modernity and liberalism and democracy. We've got everything here in Mexico. I would never go back to the United States to live. I spent time there. I was born there. But, to me, Mexico is not only my home, but it's a wonderful place to be. So we need to think out of the box a little bit, too.
Well, of course, you're ahead of us in the sense that you have an oligarchically controlled media, which is what Donald Trump is trying to do here. Exactly. Peña Nieto wouldn't exist but for the media down there. So we're going to be joining you in the battle against kind of autocratic media that supports these little tin pot dictators.
Exactly. No, I think you are, unfortunately, the United States is really entering into a stage that we are very familiar with in Latin America.
Right.
There are lots of similarities between Trump and Peña Nieto. We already mentioned that. And your battles are going to have to get, more Latin Americanized, which is not necessarily bad in terms of the fact, if you listen to Bernie Sanders, for instance, his political discourse and the language he uses is, I don't know if he did it intentionally or not, but is very similar to, the left-wing leaders in Latin America, López Obrador in Mexico, even Evo Morales in Bolivia, Lula da Silva in Brazil. Sanders is really kind of talking like a Latin American, or let's just talk about an American in the broad sense of the Americas, progressive leader. And so it's not good news that Trump is president of the United States, of course, but there is an opportunity for this to create a new union of the, of the peoples of the Americas, right?
I love it. Well,
transform.
Look, we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today, Dr. John Mill Ackerman.
Thank you, Ian. A pleasure as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who's an author as well as a professor of the Institute of Legal Research at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. He's also the vice president of the International Association for Administrative Law, and he has an article at The Atlantic, How Mexico's President Laid the Foundation for a Wall. We're going to take a brief station break and be back assessing the damage to U.S. foreign policy from the hollowing out of the State Department with abrupt departures of many of its top officials.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and he previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and the State Department's representative to NATO's Middle East Working Groups, and he also served as a State Department Intelligence Analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
Right.
So, Wayne, what do you make of all of these career Foreign Service officers at the very top of the State Department, many in very important and sensitive senior posts, under White House control, basically leaving en masse, leaving a huge leadership vacuum among the senior ranks of the State Department?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed picture, because it looks like the most senior of those officials, Kennedy, who was the he was in charge of management in the department, had gotten the message from Trump's transition team, that no, he was not being held over, and so that probably was more a case of you can't fire me, I quit. The others seem like they probably did, you know, get out, and some of their jobs are very interesting. Why they would be pretty sure they're gone. One is the or couldn't deal with the Trump situation, or wouldn't be able to execute orders. One is the individual in charge of consular affairs. Now, remember, Trump is coming in, you know, saying that he's going to change the entire visa operation to have extreme vetting of Muslim applicants, there'll definitely be a change with visas in the case of Mexico. And so these are all things that are just inconsistent, you know, with traditional consular policy. And, in fact, not even in law in the Immigration and Nationality Act and its revisions. And so I don't see how anyone with, a reasonable attitude toward consular affairs could listen to that, could execute. So there's one that you'd expect to be out. And then the second one is the head of diplomatic security. Remember, going back into the campaign, along with the FBI director, it was the director of diplomatic security that downgraded the classification of a number of the emails that Hillary got, which was part of the process of exonerating her on the part of the FBI director before his second hit, which is inexplicable and probably partisan. But anyway, they're looked upon as bad, the bad guys for letting her off. So, I mean, that guy was doomed, and I'm sure decided to get out before he was fired. But it is going to strip the department of a lot of expertise. But even more, you got to remember, they have underlings who can come up and replace them. It's not like there's a total loss there, because they have deputies. But what might also happen is the deputies might quit too if they're asked to, you know, execute orders that are radically different and they're close to retirement or at retirement.
But where do we stand on who is going to be Rex Tillerson's deputy? There's still the possibility of John Bolton, isn't there?
That's a possibility, and Bolton, of course, is chomping at the bit to get something. He was probably very dismayed that he didn't get UN ambassador, which, you know, was a great interest of his, or Secretary of State. So it depends on whether Bolton is wounded enough now to, you know, accept something that's less, you know, than what he had hoped for, you know, some months ago.
Well, but being the number two at the State Department is not small change, is it? I mean, he can have a lot of influence.
Small change, but when you actually thought you had a chance to be secretary, sure, you know, that he might chafe at that. Particularly, remember, as UN ambassador, for example, you're considered, as of about, what, 20 years ago, I think maybe during the Clinton administration this happened, the UN ambassador was made cabinet rank. And made as essentially as significant as the Secretary of State. It's not quite that. The emphasis isn't there, but it's official. And so he would be accepting, you know, a downgrading in rank.
Well, there's no secret that one, Rex Tillerson, is a friend of Putin's and has received the highest civilian award that Russia can give. And he also previously, when he headed up Exxon, had made a deal with Rosneft and Session, Putin's buddy, the head of Rosneft, who stole the oil company from Khodorkovsky. They talked about developing not just Siberian oil and gas, but also Arctic oil, based upon the very cynical notion that because of global warming, the ice is melting, and therefore the oil in the Arctic would be more accessible and less expensive to extract. And then, of course, the more oil you extract and burn, the more CO2 you produce, and the cycle is exacerbated. So there's
the rich solar doesn't care about any of that.
Yeah. So that's pretty depressing. But my understanding is that there's a general sense that, on the one hand, they want to try and make a deal with Putin and have some kind of cosmetic deal that'll look good. On the other hand, they want to go after Iran, which is Putin's ally.
Yeah, that would be an area. I mean, there are a number of areas, but that would be one area of contention. But there are some pretty dangerous areas, and that is, would Trump actually defend a NATO country? Would he actually, defend a NATO country if Putin decided to slice a piece off of, let's say, Lithuania or something like that, that happens to be largely Russian, which is just as true of some of the Baltics, for example, as it is of the Ukraine? This is the kind of stuff that I really worry about. And I do not trust Tillerson with his background, especially given Trump's parallel, leanings toward Russia, to do anything particularly harsh to the Russians. We have to keep in mind one other thing, too. There are a lot of us who suspect. We can't prove it, but we suspect that given all of Tillerson and Trump's dealings over there in Russia, and Trump even mentioned, I wasn't so stupid as to fall for their tricks in those rooms where we were meeting with the Russian officials, where they turn on all these knobs and you're obviously being recorded. Yeah, well, that's true, but they also record you in your hotel room. They record you in a lot of other venues as well that he may not have been familiar with, and they may actually have blackmail material that could deeply embarrass him. Not to mention if they hacked into anything here, campaign-related from the Republicans, that could be really perceived as ruthless and damaging. I really do fear that there is some blackmail material out there.
Well, let's hope, that these investigations will be continued. There's a lot of speculation that the Trump administration is desperately trying to cover up and kill those investigations, and that's
absolutely.
That's why they appointed these political people, that one a political guy at CIA and a political person at the DNI. So that's the assumption, that he's trying to kill those investigations and stop them dead. And, of course, Comey is now being kept over, and he's shown reluctance to explore these ties between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin.
And an example of how weak-kneed the Congress is that we had Ryan, and we also had McCain, say that they, might not vote for Tillerson, and we also had, the senator from Florida,
Rubio.
And in the end, they all caved. And the only leverage they had over Trump to get those investigations done the way they want them done, the only real leverage was to hold back Tillerson as a hostage and say, we'll confirm Tillerson when we see that investigation plowing forward and we're getting reports, from it, and we see that set up. And still now, you can have all your other nominees, but you're not getting Tillerson until we get some results. And they didn't do that. They all caved, which just showed, as far as I'm concerned, they had no real intention, of holding up Tillerson, and that Trump, being very cunning, apparently, saw it as a bluff and didn't even blink.
So in other words, McCain and Lindsey Graham were and Rubio were all essentially
Graham,
bluffing.
It was the other one, Rubio, Graham, McCain, and Ryan, and every one of them caved. And that's exactly what I expected, because I didn't think that they'd stand up to Trump, and I think that Trump knew it, and he just continued to bluster it through and didn't even make any attempt to reassure them all that much on the investigations. So they're worthless as far as a check on him.
Sure. Well, just back, though, to the State Department. your former employee, Wayne White. What about if Bolton gets in there? That would be yet another neocon close to Netanyahu who wants to go to war with Iran, and Iran's been put on this blacklist by Trump, who has signed an executive order stopping refugees from Syria coming in, but also suspending visas, etc., for people from the seven Muslim countries, with the exclusion, by the way, of sources of real terrorism to the United States, that's Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. But, of course, Iran is heavy on that list. There's tremendous diaspora here in Los Angeles of Iranians who go back and forth a lot. That's going to complicate their lives. But in general, it seems like a move in that counterintuitive direction where, on the one hand, the rationale for opening up Cuba and flights from Miami is that the Cuban diaspora will come into Cuba and basically encourage more aspirations for democracy on the part of the Cuban people and undermine the Castro regime. So how come that doesn't apply to Iran? The more connections with the Iranian diaspora and the government there, the likelihood in the long run that there'll be a moderation towards democracy and away from the theocracy and the thuggery of the IRGC.
Well, I think you and I agree on this. Essentially, Trump, in hammering away at the Muslim states, is handing a weapon to the extremists in all those countries to say, see, this is what they really think of us, particularly Iraq, that's a partner in a war that's in the middle of a battle in Mosul right now. It will encourage radicalization and alienation of populations who they won't see this as anti-radical. They'll see this as veiled anti-Muslim activity, and it'll be the negative reactions in all these countries will be much more negative and more broad than one might think. And it will be beyond the countries that have been targeted. It will extend to the exception countries as well as an insult to Muslims. Pakistanis will be angry about this. Saudis will be angry about this, even though they're not on the list right now, I think. This could also tremendously aggravate internal radicalization here at home, because it'll be one step from saying that Muslims here are second-class citizens. Trump could actually have on his hands domestic terrorism, more than we've seen up to this point, because he himself is participating in actively radicalizing.
Well, that may serve his purposes if he is the autocrat that a lot of people fear. You know, that's like burning the Reichstag. That plays right into his hands.
That's what I'm concerned about, that he'll just turn around and say, see, he's already turned against other people. Like, I'm concerned about this threat to send the army into Chicago and characterizing, you know, Chicago as a very bad place. And I think this is racist. And that what he would love to do is have, like, the National Guard deployed to Chicago, which would be very deeply resented and would produce conflict and would produce very, very loud and raucous demonstrations and some damaging of property, and then turn around and say, see, I told you. You know, he's playing the agent provocateur in these situations.
Well, Wayne White, since you were an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and when you were at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis in the State Department, Iraq was one of your, and Iran were your main focus. What did you make of Trump's remark at the CIA the other day when he really made an absolutely disgusting display of self-aggrandizement right in front of the wall of the anonymously fallen CIA officers, where he went on about his the big crowd that he imagined he had at the inauguration. And then on top of that, he went into this strange tangent where he said that he'd maybe redo the Iraq war and get it right this time and take the country's oil. So you've got Iraqi patriots alongside American advisors fighting in the battle to retake Mosul from the Islamic State. Doesn't that create tensions between the U.S. and the Iraqis? If you're going to steal their oil, they're going to look upon the Americans with suspicion, aren't they? If their leader is calling for the literally the theft.
And particularly when an Iraqi friend of mine, who is fairly prominent, queried back at me in his joke saying, does he know that the oil's in the ground and you can't sort of steal it and run away with it? It has to be pumped out for decades, but the idea of saying something that about Iraqis when we have thousands of advisors over there is extremely dangerous. We could lose lives. We could have advisors who already are very much disliked by Iraqi Shia radicals, the militias that have been occasionally part of these battles. In fact, they are fighting on the east side of Mosul, and we've been trying to keep separate from them, but they're around, and if they want to kill somebody, they can do it. And these guys are highly anti-American in most cases. A lot of them are related to the pro-Iranian Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq. This stuff could actually result in fatalities, woundings, or sabotage against our men and their bases of operation in Iraq. I'm sure when our soldiers over there, our war fighters, were hearing this, it was sending chills down their spines.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, back to the State Department and the loss of much of the top echelons of the State Department. As they lose all this institutional memory and experience, and these are bipartisan people who've served under both Republican and Democratic administrations, we now learn that buried in an omnibus bill was a little rider that took away the oversight board of Voice of America, which is a part of the State Department, and essentially has allowed now for Trump to basically take over political and editorial control of the Voice of America now that the oversight board has been removed. And guess who he's put in there? He's put two 25-year-old political operatives with virtually no experience except their ideologues. Matthew Shuck is a former staff writer at the conservative website, The Daily Surge. And the other fellow, Sapowski, is a former field director at the Americans for Prosperity Foundation, which is funded by the Koch brothers. And these characters, these two 25-year-olds, are now running VOA. That's pretty much an in-your-face insult, isn't it?
Well, watch for some resignations over there. VOA, most people don't know this, but I've been interviewed by VOA. I've dealt with them when I was in government. I was interviewed only 2 weeks ago by VOA in Libya. VOA is like the Associated Press. It's like a neutral news agency. It's the only way it keeps its credibility abroad. The reason why Trump hit the roof over VOA is because they broadcast honestly the debate in the United States over the crowd size, at the inauguration, as just a news item. And boom, you can just imagine Trump saying, who's doing this over VOA? To me, it's all personal to him. But if he takes over VOA and starts using it as a propaganda weapon, he will ruin VOA because its big foreign services are in various languages. In other words, VOA is divided up between VOA's service in English, which, is the one he can use, but there's a Persian service, there's Russian service, Chinese service, you name all the Korean. It is divided up into a lattice work of language services. And the listeners who relied on VOA for real news, for the truth, will just turn it off. They'll just say VOA's been turned into a Trump propaganda thing. They know the difference between real news and Trump's, screeds out there. And so he'll destroy VOA. So about the only thing you could use it for is for listeners in the United States, and a few listeners abroad who might agree with Trump in the English service, as a propaganda machine. Because, again, the foreign language services, they will just lose listenership by the bucketful.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq, and a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council. He was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group and previously served as the Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's turning of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists' Doomsday Clock closer to midnight.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Invasion after invasion.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Krauss, the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and foundation professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Physics Department at Arizona State University. He has won numerous international awards for both his research and his efforts to improve the public understanding of science, and he's the only physicist to have received the top awards from all three U.S. physics societies, and he's also the author of 9 books, including the bestsellers The Physics of Star Trek and A Universe from Nothing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Krauss.
It's nice to be with you virtually.
And thank you for joining us. And the Doomsday Clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was turned closer to midnight in the wake of Donald Trump's presidency. You were there for the unveiling of this bad news. We're now 30 seconds closer to midnight. Has it been this bad, or when was the last time it was this bad?
Well, this is the worst it's been in 64 years. In 1953, the clock was set to 2 minutes to midnight, right after the then Soviet Union exploded a large nuclear weapon, a hydrogen bomb, for the first time, and that was the beginning of the arms race. Since then, it's never gotten closer than 3 minutes to midnight, which it was last year and also during the height of the Cold War. So this is really the closest it's been in the lifetime of most of the people listening to your program.
Well, Thomas Pickering, who serves on the board of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, is a very senior, experienced State Department official, and you're one of the country's leading physicists. So it's not as though credible people aren't putting the clock forward. What is the basis of this trepidation?
There's a lot of things. First of all, basically, the situation, we were in a dangerous world last year, but the situation doesn't seem to be getting better. We're seeing a lot of bellicose saber rattling on both sides of the Atlantic. We have a new administration and the president who's made very disconcerting statements about nuclear weapons, about using nuclear weapons, about building up our arsenal of nuclear weapons. Really, the first time in almost 30 years anyone's talked about building up an arsenal of nuclear weapons. We already have 5,000 nuclear weapons in this country, and the Russians also have 5,000 nuclear weapons. And to argue that we need to build a bigger arsenal is frankly irrational. And moreover, we're talking about modernizing our arsenal, which would cost maybe $1 trillion and could easily violate the non-proliferation treaty. So the statements that Donald Trump has made about nuclear weapons are very concerning, but the same is true for Putin. At the same time, North Korea is now talking about having an intercontinental ballistic missile, and Pakistan is increasing its nuclear weapons fleet. So on the nuclear weapons issue, there are many items of concern, but also the Bolton looks at other existential threats, including climate change. And climate change is one area where the current administration appears to completely deny the science, deny the reality. And we can't address the problem until they accept the reality of the situation. So there's some of the things. We're also looking at emerging technologies, but the major concerns right now are the threat of the use of nuclear weapons, the threat of wasting money, a new arms race, which would destabilize, in some sense, the nuclear security of this country, and a president that doesn't seem to understand, in his verbiage anyway, the rationale for not using nuclear weapons, or the need to openly accept the scientifically established fact that climate change is happening and it's caused by humans.
Well, when Thomas Pickering says the Trump administration has been engaged in casual talk about nuclear weapons, and words matter, words count. The war scare of 1983 in November, where we almost had a nuclear war, was largely because of rhetoric. The Soviet Union, their whole system was based on rhetoric and not necessarily reality with all their five-year plans, etc. So they took rhetoric very seriously. And when Ronald Reagan talked about the Soviets ending up on the ash heap of history, they took that kind of stuff literally. One of the things that's most disturbing about Donald Trump is his first major briefing when he was president-elect came from the State Department, where all the top officials in the State Department briefed him. And all he wanted to talk about was what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. And the briefers were absolutely dumbfounded. So what do you think's going on in his head when he makes this crazy talk about nuclear weapons and maybe we should have more of them, and why hasn't anybody used them?
I think it's clear that the president doesn't think before he speaks, and so I think one has to understand that that's a problem. But the problem is he's the president of the United States, and when he speaks, as you say, words matter. People respond. It produces tensions. When he says to Vladimir Putin, we'll have an arms race in response to his tweet, and the two of them start going off, it's a problem. Then when you have the issue of sort of fake news and stories, you have people responding to those tensions. The defense minister of Pakistan responded to a fake news story saying that Israel was considering using nuclear weapons to basically say that they would respond in kind. We have a it's inappropriate for the leader of, at this time, one of the most powerful countries in the world, to not recognize that what he says has an impact on the on people around the world. And even if he's just saying something to be provocative, he has to realize that there are real security implications of those statements.
So is there any optimism? There have been some suggestions, in fact, floated by the Trump administration that maybe they can do a deal with Vladimir Putin. And, of course, it remains to be seen how deep the connections are that the intelligence community have said existed and the intention on the part of Vladimir Putin to influence the outcome of the elections, helped elect Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. Those things are still being investigated. But notwithstanding that, already the Trump people have suggested maybe they'll have a kind of Reykjavik-type meeting with Putin and do a kind of swap where they'll ease sanctions on Ukraine in exchange for some dramatic nuclear reduction deal, which already my understanding is that the Russian military have absolutely no interest in. So in terms of the dynamics between the U.S. and Russia over nuclear reductions, is it true that the Russians feel they need their nuclear deterrent more than, say, we do?
Well, I think they're concerned about our putting missile defense systems in Europe that really appear to be designed to they're claimed to be responding to Iran, but they appear, but in fact, that what they would do is, although they don't really work, but they're really aimed at trying to minimize the effectiveness of the Russian nuclear deterrent. But I think, your first question is really more important. What I said in when we introduced the clock is that there is a real opportunity. If Putin and Trump really believe what they say about respecting each other, they can begin together. They have an opportunity here to act like statesmen and not petulant children. There is an opportunity for them to try and work together to reduce nuclear weapons in both countries, to reduce the level of alertness, all the things we've talked about to try and bring the world back from the brink. So it would be great if this supposed new relationship blossomed instead of two people trying to basically be the biggest person in the schoolyard. And we'll wait and see what happens. But we when we speak out, we're urging both President Trump and President Putin to take advantage of this opportunity to reduce the level of nuclear arms and reduce nuclear tensions around the world and address climate change together, et cetera. So maybe that message will get through. I certainly hope so. But our feeling is what we also told the public is that we can't just leave it in the hands of a few people. We're calling on the people of the world to speak out about these issues and to talk to politicians and talk to the leaders, because that's the only way things will really change. One of the reasons why we have the doomsday clock and one of the reasons why we speak out to the public is to inform them, and the public can act appropriately.
Well, when you said a minute ago, Lawrence Krauss, that the defensive shield the U.S. wants to deploy in Eastern Europe is meant for Iran, but it's upsetting the Russians, but it nevertheless may not work. The Russians, of course, have deployed nuclear-capable missiles in the enclave on the Baltic, Kaliningrad, and the U.S. has deployed the THAAD missile system in North Korea, concerned about a North Korean launch. Does THAAD work? Because the Chinese are furious at that, and they have sanctioned South Korea as a result.
No, I think, you're hitting the point that these, even if these missiles, in my opinion, missile defense systems are also destabilizing. Generally, they don't work. But what they generally do is encourage more offensive actions to try and combat the defensive systems, just in case they might work. They also produce increase international tensions. Wouldn't it be much better if you're worried about nuclear weapons to try and work together to try and reduce the number of nuclear weapons? I mean, we have enough. 100 nuclear weapons would be enough to deter any country in the world. You don't need 5,000. It just doesn't make sense. And it's about time the world began to step back. The more nuclear weapons we have, the more likely there'll be an accident, the more likely there'll be an accidental use of it. And anyone who wants to try and design new nuclear weapons to try and make them usable is leading themselves down to a road to potential oblivion. The old statement of Robert Oppenheimer that we're like two scorpions in a bottle, you know, we can sting each other to death, is still true. And what caused the doomsday clock to be created in 1947 still rings true. The world hangs under the threat of nuclear weapons, and we have to do something about it. We've become complacent because they haven't been used in war in 60, 70 years, but that doesn't mean it will never happen. And that's part of the purpose of our efforts, is to try maybe once a year, for a day at least, raise these issues for people so they begin to realize the importance of dealing with them.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Krauss.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Krauss, who's the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and foundation professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Physics Department at Arizona State University. He has won numerous international awards for both his research and his efforts to improve the public understanding of science, and he's the only physicist to have received the top awards from all three U.S. physics societies, and he's also the author of 9 books, including the bestsellers The Physics of Star Trek and A Universe from Nothing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.